Old Masson, the caretaker of one of Salem's oldest and most neglected cemeteries, had a feud with the rats. Generations ago, they had come up from the wharves and settled in the graveyard, a colony of abnormally large rats. And when Masson had taken charge after the inexplicable disappearance of the former caretaker, he decided that they must go. At first, he set traps for them and put poison food by their burrows, and later he tried to shoot them, but it did no good. The rats stayed, multiplying and overrunning the graveyard with their ravenous hordes. They were large, even for the brown rat, which sometimes measures 15 inches in length, exclusive of the naked pink and gray tail. Masson had caught glimpses of some as large as good-sized cats, and when, once or twice, the gravediggers had uncovered their burrows, the malodorous tunnels were large enough to enable a man to crawl into them on his hands and knees. The ships that had come generations ago from distant ports to the rotting Salem wharves had brought strange cargoes. Masson wondered sometimes at the extraordinary size of these burrows. He recalled certain vaguely disturbing legends he had heard since coming to ancient witch-haunted Salem, tales of a moribund, inhuman life that was said to exist in forgotten burrows in the earth. The old days when Cotton Mather had hunted down the evil cults that worshipped Hecate and the dark Magna Mater and frightful orgies had passed, but dark gabled houses still leaned perilously toward each other over narrow cobbled streets, and blasphemous secrets and mysteries were said to be hidden in subterranean cellars and caverns, where forgotten pagan rites were still celebrated in defiance of law and sanity. Wagging their gray heads wisely, the elders declared that there were worse things than rats and maggots crawling in the unhallowed earth of the ancient Salem cemeteries. And then, too, there was this curious dread of the rats. Masson disliked and respected the ferocious little rodents, for he knew the danger that lurked in their flashing, needle-sharp fangs. But he could not understand the inexplicable horror which the oldsters held for deserted, rat-infested houses. He had heard vague rumors of ghoulish beings that dwelt far underground and that had the power of commanding the rats, marshaling them like horrible armies. The rats, the old men whispered, were messengers between this world and the grim and ancient caverns far below Salem. Bodies had been stolen from graves for nocturnal subterranean feasts, they said. The myth of the Pied Piper is a fable that hides a blasphemous horror, and the black pits of Avernus have brought forth hellspawn monstrosities that never venture into the light of day. Masson paid little attention to these tales. He did not fraternize with his neighbors, and in fact did all he could to hide the existence of the rats from intruders. Investigation, he realized, would undoubtedly mean the opening of many graves. And while some of the gnawed, empty coffins could be attributed to the activities of the rats, Masson might find it difficult to explain the mutilated bodies that lay in some of the coffins. The purest gold is used in filling teeth, and this gold is not removed when a man is buried. Clothing, of course, is another matter, for usually the undertaker provides a plain broadcloth suit that is cheap and easily recognizable. But gold is another matter, and sometimes, too, there were medical students and less reputable doctors who were in need of cadavers and not over-scrupulous as to where these were obtained. So far, Masson had successfully managed to discourage investigation. He had fiercely denied the existence of the rats, even though they sometimes robbed him of his prey. Masson did not care what happened to the bodies after he had performed his gruesome thefts, but the rats inevitably dragged away the whole cadaver through the hole they gnawed in the coffin. The size of these burrows occasionally worried Masson. Then, too, there was the curious circumstance of the coffins always being gnawed open at the end, never at the side or top. It was almost as though the rats were working under the direction of some impossibly intelligent leader. Now he stood in an open grave and threw a last sprinkling of wet earth on the heap beside the pit. It was raining, a slow, cold drizzle that for weeks had been descending from soggy black clouds. The graveyard was a slough of yellow, sucking mud, from which the rain-washed tombstones stood up in irregular battalions. The rats had retreated to their burrows, and Masson had not seen one for days, but his gaunt, unshaven face was set in frowning lines. The coffin on which he was standing was a wooden one. The body had been buried several days earlier, but Masson had not dared to disinter it before. A relative of the dead man had been coming to the grave at intervals, even in the drenching rain. But he would hardly come at this late hour, no matter how much grief he might be suffering, Masson thought, grinning wryly. He straightened and laid the shovel aside. From the hill on which the ancient graveyard lay, he could see the lights of Salem flickering dimly through the downpour. He drew a flashlight from his pocket. He would need light now. Taking up the spade, he bent and examined the fastenings of the coffin. Abruptly, he stiffened. Beneath his feet, he sensed an unquiet stirring and scratching, as though something were moving within the coffin. For a moment, a pang of superstitious fear shot through Masson, and then rage replaced it as he realized the significance of the sound. The rats had forestalled him again. In a paroxysm of anger, Masson wrenched at the fastenings of the coffin. He got the sharp edge of the shovel under the lid and pried it up until he could finish the job with his hands. Then he sent the flashlight's cold beam darting down into the coffin. Rain spattered against the white satin lining. The coffin was empty. Masson saw a flicker of movement at the head of the case and darted the light in that direction. The end of the sarcophagus had been gnawed through, and a gaping hole led into darkness. A black shoe, limp and dragging, was disappearing as Masson watched, and abruptly he realized that the rats had forestalled him by only a few minutes. He fell on his hands and knees and made a hasty clutch at the shoe, and the flashlight incontinently fell into the coffin and went out. The shoe was tugged from his grasp. He heard a sharp, excited squealing, and then he had the flashlight again and was darting its light into the burrow. It was a large one. It had to be, or the corpse could not have been dragged along it. Masson wondered at the size of the rats that could carry away a man's body, but the thought of the loaded revolver in his pocket fortified him. Probably if the corpse had been an ordinary one, Masson would have left the rats with their spoils, rather than venture into the narrow burrow. But he remembered an especially fine set of cufflinks he had observed, as well as a stick pin that was undoubtedly a genuine pearl. With scarcely a pause, he clipped the flashlight to his belt and crept into the burrow. It was a tight fit, but he managed to squeeze himself along. Ahead of him in the flashlight's glow, he could see the shoes dragging along the wet earth on the bottom of the tunnel. He crept along the burrows as rapidly as he could, occasionally barely able to squeeze his lean body through the narrow walls. The air was overpowering with its musty stench of carrion. If he could not reach the corpse in a minute, Masson decided, he would turn back. Belated fears were beginning to crawl maggot-like within his mind, but greed urged him on. He crawled forward, several times passing the mouths of adjoining tunnels. The walls of the burrow were damp and slimy, and twice lumps of dirt dropped behind him. The second time he paused and screwed his head around to look back. He could see nothing, of course, until he had unhooked the flashlight from his belt and reversed it. Several clods lay on the ground behind him, and the danger of his position suddenly became real and terrifying. With thoughts of a cave-in making his pulse race, he decided to abandon the pursuit, even though he had now almost overtaken the corpse and the invisible things that pulled it. But he had overlooked one thing. The burrow was too narrow to allow him to turn. Panic touched him briefly, but he remembered a side tunnel he had just passed and backed awkwardly along the tunnel until he came to it. He thrust his legs into it, backing until he found himself able to turn. Then he hurriedly began to retrace his way, although his knees were bruised and painful. Agonizing pain shot through his leg. He felt sharp teeth sink into his flesh and kicked out frantically. There was a shrill squealing and a scurry of many feet. Flashing the light behind him, Masson caught his breath in a sob of fear as he saw a dozen great rats watching him intently, their slitted eyes glittering in the light. They were great misshapen things, as large as cats, and behind them he caught a glimpse of a dark shape that stirred and moved swiftly aside into the shadow, and he shuddered at the unbelievable size of the thing. The light had held them for a moment, but they were edging closer, their teeth dull orange in the pale light. Masson tugged at his pistol, managed to extricate it from his pocket, and aimed carefully. It was an awkward position, and he tried to press his feet into the soggy sides of the burrow so that he should not inadvertently send a bullet into one of them. The rolling thunder of the shot deafened him for a time, and the clouds of smoke set him coughing. When he could hear again and the smoke had cleared, he saw that the rats were gone. He put the pistol back and began to creep swiftly along the tunnel, and then with a scurry and a rush, they were upon him again. They swarmed over his legs, biting and squealing insanely, and Masson shrieked horribly as he snatched for his gun. He fired without aiming, and only luck saved him from blowing a foot off. This time the rats did not retreat so far, but Masson was crawling as swiftly as he could along the burrow, ready to fire again at the first sound of another attack. There was a patter of feet, and he sent the light stabbing behind him. A great gray rat paused and watched him. Its long ragged whiskers twitched, and its scabrous naked tail was moving slowly from side to side. Masson shouted, and the rat retreated. He crawled on, pausing briefly, the black gap of a side tunnel at his elbow, as he made out a shapeless huddle on the damp clay a few yards ahead. For a second, he thought it was the mass of earth that had been dislodged from the roof, and then he recognized it as a human body. It was a brown and shriveled mummy, and with a dreadful, unbelieving shock, Masson realized that it was moving. It was crawling towards him, and in the pale glow of the flashlight, the man saw a frightful gargoyle face thrust into his own. It was the passionless death's head skull of a long-dead corpse, instinct with hellish life, and the glazed eyes, swollen and bulbous, betrayed the thing's blindness. It made a faint groaning sound as it crawled toward Masson, stretching its ragged and granulated lips in a grin of dreadful hunger, and Masson was frozen with abysmal fear and loathing. Just before the horror touched him, Masson flung himself frantically into the burrow at his side. He heard a scrambling noise at his heels, and the thing groaned dully as it came after him. Masson, glancing over his shoulder, screamed and propelled himself desperately through the narrow burrow. He crawled along awkwardly, sharp stones cutting his hands and knees. Dirt showered into his eyes, but he dared not pause even for a moment. He scrambled on, gasping, cursing, and praying hysterically. Squealing triumphantly, the rats came at him, horrible hunger in their eyes. Masson almost succumbed to their vicious teeth before he succeeded in beating them off. The passage was narrowing, and in a frenzy of terror, he kicked and screamed and fired until the hammer clicked on an empty shell, but he had driven them off. He found himself crawling under a great stone, embedded in the roof, that dug cruelly into his back. It moved a little as his weight struck it, and an idea flashed into Masson's fright-crazed mind. If he could bring down the stone so that it blocked the tunnel. The earth was wet and soggy from the rains, and he hunched himself half upright and dug away at the dirt around the stone. The rats were coming closer. He saw their eyes glowing in the reflection of the flashlight's beam. Still, he clawed frantically at the earth. The stone was giving. He tugged at it, and it rocked in its foundation. A rat was approaching, the monster he had already glimpsed. Gray and leprous and hideous, it crept forward with its orange teeth bared, and in its wake came the blind dead thing, groaning as it crawled. Masson gave a last frantic tug at the stone. He felt it slide downwards, and then he went scrambling along the tunnel. Behind him, the stone crashed down, and he heard a sudden frightful shriek of agony. Clods showered upon his legs. A heavy weight fell on his feet, and he dragged them free with difficulty. The entire tunnel was collapsing. Gasping with fear, Masson threw himself forward as the soggy earth collapsed at his heels. The tunnel narrowed until he could barely use his hands and legs to propel himself. He wriggled forward like an eel and suddenly felt satin tearing beneath his clawing fingers, and then his head crashed against something that barred his path. He moved his legs, discovering that they were not pinned under the collapsed earth. He was lying flat on his stomach, and when he tried to raise himself, he found that the roof was only a few inches from his back. Panic shot through him. When the blind horror had blocked his path, he had flung himself desperately into a side tunnel, a tunnel that had no outlet. He was in a coffin, an empty coffin into which he had crept through the hole the rats had gnawed in its end. He tried to turn on his back and found that he could not. The lid of the coffin pinned him down inexorably. Then he braced himself and strained at the coffin lid. It was immovable, and even if he could escape from the sarcophagus, how could he claw his way up through 5 feet of hard-packed earth? He found himself gasping. It was dreadfully fetid, unbearably hot. In a paroxysm of terror, he ripped and clawed at the satin until it was shredded. He made a futile attempt to dig with his feet at the earth from the collapsed burrow that blocked his retreat. If he were only able to reverse his position, he might be able to claw his way through to air. White-hot agony lanced through his breast, throbbed in his eyeballs. His head seemed to be swelling, growing larger and larger, and suddenly he heard the exultant squealing of the rats. He began to scream insanely, but could not drown them out. For a moment, he thrashed about hysterically within his narrow prison, and then he was quiet, gasping for air. His eyelids closed, his blackened tongue protruded, and he sank down into the blackness of death with the mad squealing of the rats dinning in his ears. In my tortured ears, there sounds unceasingly a nightmare whirring and flapping, and a faint, distant baying as of some gigantic hound. It is not a dream. It is not, I fear, even madness, for too much has already happened to give me these merciful doubts. St. John is a mangled corpse. I alone know why, and such is my knowledge that I am about to blow out my brains, for fear I shall be mangled in the same way. Down unlit and illimitable corridors of eldritch fantasy sweeps the black, shapeless nemesis that drives me to self-annihilation. May heaven forgive the folly and morbidity which led us both to so monstrous a fate. Wearied with the commonplaces of a prosaic world, where even the joys of romance and adventure soon grow stale, St. John and I had followed enthusiastically every aesthetic and intellectual movement which promised respite from our devastating ennui. The enigmas of the symbolists and the ecstasies of the pre-Raphaelites all were ours in their time, but each new mood was drained too soon of its diverting novelty and appeal. Only the somber philosophy of the decadence could help us, and this we found potent only by increasing gradually the depth and diabolism of our penetrations. Baudelaire and Huysmans were soon exhausted of thrills, till finally there remained for us only the more direct stimuli of unnatural personal experiences and adventures. It was this frightful emotional need which led us eventually to that detestable course, which even in my present fear I mention with shame and timidity, that hideous extremity of human outrage, the abhorred practice of grave robbing. I cannot reveal the details of our shocking expedition, or catalog even partly the worst of the trophies adorning the nameless museum we jointly dwelt, alone and servantless. Our museum was a blasphemous, unthinkable place, where with the satanic taste of neurotic virtuosi, we had assembled a universe of terror and a secret room far, far underground, where huge winged demons, carven of basalt and onyx, vomited from wide grinning mouths weird green and orange light, and hidden pneumatic pipes ruffled into kaleidoscopic dances of death, the line of red charnel things hand in hand woven in voluminous black hangings. Through these pipes came at will the odors our moods most craved, sometimes the scent of pale funeral lilies, sometimes the narcotic incense of imagined eastern shrines of the kingly dead, and sometimes, how I shudder to recall it, the frightful soul-upheaving stenches of the uncovered grave. Around the walls of this repellent chamber were cases of antique mummies alternating with comely, lifelike bodies, perfectly stuffed and cured by the taxidermist's art, and with headstones snatched from the oldest churchyards of the world. Niches here and there contained skulls of all shapes, and heads preserved in various stages of dissolution. There one might find the rotting bald pates of famous noblemen and the flesh and radiantly golden heads of new buried children. Statues and paintings there were, all of fiendish subjects, and some executed by St. John and myself. A locked portfolio, bound in tanned human skin, held certain unknown and unnameable drawings which it was rumored Goya had perpetrated, but dared not acknowledge. There were nauseous musical instruments, stringed brass woodwind, on which St. John and I sometimes produced dissonances of exquisite morbidity and cacodemoniacal ghastliness, whilst in a multitude of inlaid ebony cabinets reposed the most incredible and unimaginable variety of tomb loot ever assembled by human madness and perversity. It is of this loot in particular that I must not speak. Thank God I had the courage to destroy it long before I thought of destroying myself. The predatory excursions on which we collected our unmentionable treasures were always artistically memorable events. We were no vulgar ghouls, but worked only under certain conditions of mood, landscape, environment, weather, season, and moonlight. These pastimes were, to us, the most exquisite form of aesthetic expression, and we gave their details a fastidious technical care. An inappropriate hour, a jarring lighting effect, or a clumsy manipulation of the damp sod would almost totally destroy for us that ecstatic titillation which followed the exhumation of some ominous grinning secret of the earth. Our quest for novel scenes and piquant conditions was feverish and insatiate. St. John was always the leader, and he it was who led the way at last to that mocking, accursed spot which brought us our hideous and inevitable doom. By what malign fatality were we lured to that terrible Holland churchyard? I think it was the dark rumor and legendary, the tales of one buried for 5 centuries, who had himself been a ghoul in his time, and had stolen a potent thing from a mighty sepulcher. I can recall the scene in these final moments, the pale autumnal moon over the graves, casting long horrible shadows, The grotesque trees, drooping sullenly to meet the neglected grass and the crumbling slabs. The vast legions of strangely colossal bats that flew against the moon. The antique ivied church pointing a huge spectral finger at the livid sky. The phosphorescent insects that danced like death fires under the yews in a distant corner. The odors of mold, vegetation, and less explicable things that mingled feebly with the night wind from over far swamps and seas. And worst of all, the faint, deep-toned baying of some gigantic hound, which we could neither see nor definitely place. As we heard this suggestion of baying, we shuddered, remembering the tales of the peasantry. For he whom we had sought had centuries before been found in this selfsame spot, torn and mangled by the claws and teeth of some unspeakable beast. I remember how we delved into the ghoul's grave with our spades, and how we thrilled at the picture of ourselves, the grave, the pale watching moon, the horrible shadows, the grotesque trees, the titanic bats, the antique church, the dancing death fires, the sickening odors, the gently moaning night wind, and the strange, half-heard, directionless baying of whose objective existence we could scarcely be sure. Then we struck a substance harder than the damp mold, and beheld a rotting oblong box, crusted with mineral deposits from the long undisturbed ground. It was incredibly tough and thick, but so old that we finally pried it open and feasted our eyes on what it held. Much, amazingly much, was left of the object, despite the lapse of 500 years. The skeleton, though crushed in places by the jaws of the thing that had killed it, held together with surprising firmness, and we gloated over the clean white skull and its long firm teeth and its eyeless sockets that had once glowed with a charnel fever like our own. In the coffin lay an amulet of curious and exotic design, which had apparently been worn around the sleeper's neck. It was the oddly conventionalized figure of a crouching winged hound, or sphinx with a semi-canine face, and was exquisitely carved in antique oriental fashion from a small piece of green jade. The expression of its features was repellent in the extreme, savoring at once of death, bestiality, and malevolence. Around the base was an inscription in characters which neither St. John nor I could identify, and on the bottom, like a maker's seal, was graven a grotesque and formidable skull. Immediately upon beholding this amulet, we knew that we must possess it, that this treasure alone was our logical pelf from the centuried grave. Even had its outlines been unfamiliar, we would have desired it, but as we looked more closely, we saw that it was not wholly unfamiliar. Alien it indeed was to all art and literature which sane and balanced readers know, but we recognized it as the thing hinted of in the forbidden Necronomicon of the mad Arab Abdul al-Hazred, the ghastly soul symbol of the corpse-eating cult of inaccessible Leng in Central Asia. All too well did we trace the sinister lineaments described by the old Arab demonologist. Lineaments, he wrote, drawn from some obscure supernatural manifestation of the souls of those who vexed and gnawed at the dead. Seizing the green jade object, we gave a last glance at the bleached and cavern-eyed face of its owner, and closed up the grave as we found it. As we hastened from the abhorrent spot, the stolen amulet in St. John's pocket, we thought we saw the bats descend in a body to the earth we had so lately rifled, as if seeking for some cursed and unholy nourishment, but the autumn moon shone weak and pale, so we could not be sure. So too, as we sailed the next day away from Holland to our home, we thought we heard the faint distant baying of some gigantic hound in the background. But the autumn wind moaned sad and wan, and we could not be sure. Less than a week after our return to England, strange things began to happen. We lived as recluses, devoid of friends, alone, and without servants in a few rooms of an ancient manor house on a bleak and unfrequented moor, so that our doors were seldom disturbed by the knock of the visitor. Now, however, we were troubled by what seemed to be a frequent fumbling in the night, not only around the doors, but around the windows also, upper as well as lower. Once we fancied that a large opaque body darkened the library window when the moon was shining against it, and another time we thought we heard a whirring or flapping sound not far off. On each occasion, investigation revealed nothing, and we began to ascribe the occurrences to imagination, which still prolonged in our ears the faint far baying we thought we had heard in the Holland churchyard. The jade amulet now reposed in a niche in our museum, and sometimes we burned a strangely scented candle before it. We read much in Al-Hazred's Necronomicon about its properties, and about the relation of ghost souls to the objects it symbolized, and we were disturbed by what we read. Then terror came. On the night of September 24th, I heard a knock at my chamber door. Fancying it St. John's, I bade the knocker enter, but was answered only by a shrill laugh. There was no one in the corridor. When I aroused St. John from his sleep, he professed entire ignorance of the event and became as worried as I. It was the night that the faint, distant baying over the moor became to us a certain and dreaded reality. 4 days later, while we were both in the hidden museum, there came a low, cautious scratching at the single door which led to the secret library staircase. Our alarm was now divided, for, besides our fear of the unknown, we had always entertained a dread that our grisly collection might be discovered. Extinguishing all lights, we proceeded to the door and threw it suddenly open, whereupon we felt an unaccountable rush of air and heard, as if receding far away, a queer combination of rustling, tittering, and articulate chatter. Whether we were mad, dreaming, or in our senses, we did not try to determine. We only realized, with the blackest of apprehensions, that the apparently disembodied chatter was beyond a doubt in the Dutch language. After that, we lived in growing horror and fascination. Mostly, we held to the theory that we were jointly going mad from our life of unnatural excitements, but sometimes it pleased us more to dramatize ourselves as the victims of some creeping and appalling doom. Bizarre manifestations were now too frequent to count. Our lonely house was seemingly alive with the presence of some malign being whose nature we could not guess, and every night that demonic baying rolled over the windswept moor, always louder and louder. On October 29th, we found in the soft earth underneath the library window a series of footprints utterly impossible to describe. They were as baffling as the hordes of great bats which haunted the old manor house in unprecedented and increasing numbers. The horror reached a culmination on November 18th, when St. John, walking home after dark from the dismal railway station, was seized by some frightful carnivorous thing and torn to ribbons. His screams had reached the house, and I had hastened to the terrible scene in time to hear a whir of wings and see a vague black cloudy thing silhouetted against the rising moon. My friend was dying when I spoke to him, and he could not answer coherently. All he could do was whisper, "The amulet, that damned thing." Then he collapsed, an inert mass of mangled flesh. I buried him the next midnight in one of our neglected gardens and mumbled over his body one of the devilish rituals he had loved in life. And as I pronounced the last demonic sentence, I heard afar on the moor the faint baying of some gigantic hound. The moon was up, but I dared not look at it. And when I saw on the dim-lighted moor a wide nebulous shadow sweeping from mound to mound, I shut my eyes and threw myself face down upon the ground. When I arose, trembling, I know not how much later, I staggered into the house and made shocking obeisances before the enshrined amulet of green jade. Being now afraid to live alone in the ancient house on the moor, I departed on the following day for London, taking with me the amulet after destroying by fire and burial the rest of the impious collection in the museum. But after 3 nights I heard the baying again, and before a week was over felt strange eyes upon me whenever it was dark. One evening as I strolled on Victoria Embankment for some needed air, I saw a black shape obscure one of the reflections of the lamps in the water. A wind, stronger than the night wind, rushed by, and I knew that what had befallen St. John must soon befall me. The next day, I carefully wrapped the green jade amulet and sailed for Holland. What mercy I might gain by returning the thing to its silent sleeping owner, I knew not, but I felt that I must try any step conceivably logical. What the hound was and why it had pursued me were questions still vague, but I had first heard the baying in that ancient churchyard, and every subsequent event, including St. John's dying whisper, had served to connect the curse with the stealing of the amulet. Accordingly, I sank into the nethermost abysses of despair when, at an inn in Rotterdam, I discovered that thieves had despoiled me of this sole means of salvation. The baying was loud that evening, and in the morning I read of a nameless deed in the vilest quarter of the city. The rabble were in terror, for upon an evil tenement had fallen a red death beyond the foulest previous crime of the neighborhood. In a squalid thieves' den, an entire family had been torn to shreds by an unknown thing which left no trace, and those around had heard all night a faint, deep, insistent note as of a gigantic hound. So at last I stood again in the unwholesome churchyard, where a pale winter moon cast hideous shadows, and leafless trees drooped sullenly to meet the withered, frosty grass and cracking slabs, and the ivied church pointed a jeering finger at the unfriendly sky, and the night wind howled maniacally from over frozen swamps and frigid seas. The baying was very faint now, and it ceased altogether as I approached the ancient grave I had once violated, and frightened away an abnormally large horde of bats which had been hovering curiously around it. I know not why I went thither, unless to pray, or gibber out insane pleas and apologies to the calm white thing that lay within. But whatever my reason, I attacked the half-frozen sod with a desperation partly mine, and partly that of a dominating will outside myself. Excavation was much easier than I had expected, though at one point I encountered a queer interruption, when a lean vulture darted down out of the cold sky and pecked frantically at the grave earth until I killed him with a blow of my spade. Finally, I reached the rotting oblong box and removed the damp nitrous cover. This is the last rational act I ever performed. For crouched within that centuried coffin, embraced by a close-packed nightmare retinue of huge, sinewy, sleeping bats, was the bony thing my friend and I had robbed, not clean and placid as we had seen it then, but covered with caked blood and shreds of alien flesh and hair, and leering sentiently at me, with phosphorescent sockets and sharp and sanguine fangs, yawning twistedly in mockery of my inevitable doom. And when it gave from those grinning jaws a deep sardonic bay, as of some gigantic hound, and I saw that it held in its gory, filthy claw the lost and fateful amulet of green jade, I merely screamed and ran away idiotically, my screams soon dissolving into peals of hysterical laughter. Madness rides the star wind, claws and teeth sharpened on centuries of corpses, dripping death astride a bacchanal of bats from nigh-black ruins of buried temples of Belial. Now, as the baying of that dead, fleshless monstrosity grows louder and louder, and the stealthy whirring and flapping of those accursed web wings circles closer and closer, I shall seek with my revolver the oblivion which is my only refuge from the unnamed and the unnameable. When the estate of my uncle, Alfred Fry, is finally settled, I shall give the farm to George Harris. I would not spend another night in the house for all creation. But Harris is a strange, elemental sort of man. He hated Uncle Alfred when he worked for him, and now that my uncle is gone, he hates him still. I think it actually amuses him, and as a matter of fact, I'm almost certain that I heard him laugh aloud and shout "pig" in a mocking falsetto on that last amazing night that I spent at the farmhouse. There was the clatter of sharp hooves on the bare floor of the hall, and the unmistakable grunting snuffle of a hog. The incongruous sound passed along the corridor to the end where Harris's cubbyhole of a room was. I strode to my door and flung it open, and it was at that moment that I heard Harris's roar of mirth and the malicious "pig," as if he were calling the swine to dinner. I accused him of it later, but he denied it. If that had been all, I might have been able to persuade myself that my imagination was responsible. But it was not all, not by any means. As a child, I have a vague memory of a tremendously fat man attending the funeral for my mother and father. This, I think, must have been the first time that I ever saw him, but I'm sure that I did not set eyes on him again for over 15 years. Although there is much of my unhappy childhood that I have forgotten, Uncle Alfred's grotesque figure must have stood out in my memory in all its terrifying bulk. After all those years, I met Uncle Alfred as a result of a rather uncomfortable coincidence. Having left the university with an excellently engraved but otherwise worthless degree, I was at length fortunate enough to obtain a job in New York City as a process server. In most cases, to serve a defendant with a summons requires little more skill than that which might be expected of an errand boy, but it does occasionally happen that considerable ingenuity is necessary. Such a case was that of Uncle Alfred. When my employer gave me the summons for Alfred Fry, he told me that he had been trying to serve it for months and that he had exhausted every dodge in his head. "Try anything you can think of," he said. "I'm beginning to believe the man doesn't exist." I said, "If he's the man I think he is, the job's as good as done." And I left the office with a vision of my triumph in my mind. It was easy, I would say on my return. Why, there was nothing to it at all. Alfred Fry lived in a big gray stone house just off Fifth Avenue, a townhouse, a residence, the stately, ugly, dignified sort of dwelling that millionaires inhabit. The front doors were plate glass and wrought iron, and as I rang the bell, it occurred to me that it would be far from safe to put my foot in the crack when the door was opened. Presently, a haggard, sickly-looking butler asked me my business. "Is Mr. Alfred Fry at home?" I asked. The butler believed that Mr. Fry was not at home. I said, if you should happen to find him somewhere in there, would you tell him that his nephew, Julian Barrow, would like to pay his respects? The butler stared at me doubtfully, and I repeated, Julian Barrow. The butler said, I'll see if Mr. Fry is in, and started to close the door. Before the latch clicked, I said, tell him I don't want to borrow any money. He disappeared into the interior darkness without making any sign of having heard. After what seemed a long time, he returned and said, Mr. Fry will see you. I followed the butler through a long, gloomy hall that was draped and carpeted in dark red and gold. There were several massive pieces of carved furniture, the sort of thing that seems to have been made for the lobbies of hotels whose guests are giants. Chairs too large for one person but too small for two, tables too high for convenience, mirrors too large for comfort. We came to a broad oak door where the butler stopped. Murmuring, Mr. Fry is in the study, he swung it open, and I went in. From behind his enormous desk, my uncle peered at me. So, he said in a high, thin voice, you are Julian. And you, I said, are Uncle Alfred. I remember you. And the odd thing is that I did actually remember him. Seeing him again, I wondered how his memory could ever have grown so dim. It was like seeing a motion picture or a play for the second time, inadvertently. Though apparently you had forgotten everything about it, with the first sequence the whole thing comes back in complete detail. I suppose he had changed, he must have changed in 15 years, but it seemed to me that I remembered him exactly as I saw him now. The man was a hog. That is the most accurate, if not the most charitable way to put it. Not having seen him, you may conclude that Uncle Alfred was merely a sufferer from some such disease as dropsy or elephantiasis, but he was no invalid. On the contrary, he appeared to be in the best of health and spirits, like a vigorous hog. His head was huge and bald, except for a few long strands of straight black hair on the crown. The bulging jowls began just below the rounded brow and descended in a sweeping curve that cradled the chin. The nose was short, the tip raised in such a way that it seemed to be lifting the upper lip also. The eyes were small, closely set, and so deeply embedded that the lids were not visible. They were keen, restless eyes that darted from object to object as if in hungry search for something. I caught myself wondering what he was looking for, a carrot, an ear of corn? Well, sit down, he said. Sit down, my boy. The last time I saw you, you were a baby, and now look at you, a grown man. Tell me how you are, what you're doing. Did you know that you are my nearest living relative? His eyes made a quick search of the room for nearer relatives. It amused me to think of the summons in my pocket and of how angry my uncle would be when I served it on him, and it seemed to me that the longer I delayed, the greater the joke. So I sat down and answered his questions volubly. His curiosity about my life somewhat surprised me, for in the past his interest and his help would have been eagerly welcomed, but he had ignored my existence, and had even failed to reply to my guardian's letters. Uncle Alfred was obviously impatient with the account I gave him of my childhood. He grunted and twiddled his fat thumbs that just managed to meet across his belly, and it was not until I mentioned my fiancée that he seemed to prick up his rather pointed ears. Ah, he said, you must tell me about this girl. Her name? Annette Worth. She is young, of course. Beautiful, surely. You love her very much? Why, yes, I said, certainly. His sudden eagerness annoyed me in some obscure way. You're a lucky boy, a lucky boy. He sighed reflectively. And when is the marriage to be? Before I could draw breath, he answered his own question. Why, that depends on Uncle Alfred. That's why you came here today. Will Uncle Alfred give his loving nephew enough money so that he can be married? I was angry, but at the same time delighted. How could he have stepped into the trap more effectively? I got to my feet and smiled down at his obese head. Why, no, my dear uncle, I said. My reason for coming here was nothing of the sort. It was simply a matter of business. I reached into my pocket and drew out the paper. I have here a summons for one Alfred Fry. It gives me pleasure to serve it on you. And I slapped it down on the desk in front of him. He snatched it up in his puffy hands and let out a squeal of rage that was exactly like the sound of a pig caught under a gate. I laughed at him and started toward the door. Wait, he called after me. Wait, Julian. I turned and was amazed to see that his face was creased and folded into a kind of porcine smile. Don't go. Come back and sit down. This, he picked up the summons and flung it aside, doesn't mean anything. I should have had to settle the case eventually anyhow. I'm sorry for what I said. Now be a good boy, come back, and let's be friends. I had nothing to lose, and although I did not like my uncle, His remarkable change of manner excited my curiosity and impelled me to accept his invitation. It was as simple a thing as returning to my chair that altered the whole probable course of my life. My uncle sang a tune to the title Blood is Thicker Than Water. It was a sweet, subtle melody and well calculated to fall pleasantly on my ears. I was broke and I was in love. Uncle Alfred was rich and lonely, and after all, I was his nearest blood relative, the logical person to inherit his fortune. With a hint of tears in his shoe-button eyes, he described to me the misunderstanding and ridicule that had cursed his life. He had no friends, a woman's love he had never known. Even his own relations, among them his brother, my father, had refused him their sympathies. In short, it was a melancholy recital. Late in the afternoon, he began to plead with me to invite Annette to his house, and nothing would do but that we must stay for dinner. From the moment of Annette's arrival, Uncle Alfred's manner changed again. He stopped his moaning and became on the instant a picture of pathetic and almost absurd gallantry. In every way possible, he showed Annette that she was welcome, that she was much more than welcome. As the evening wore on, he became more and more outspoken in his praises both for Annette and for me. We were his beloved, long-lost niece and nephew, the darlings of his old age sent by Providence to comfort his final years. In leaving him, the last thing that he said to us was, "Remember, children, I have great plans for you, great plans for us all." When we were out on the street and the door closed behind us, I asked Annette, "Well, what do you think of him?" "The poor old man," she said. "It's not his fault he's so fat." "Perhaps not entirely," I said, "but to judge by the way he acted at dinner, he had something to do with it." "You mustn't be too critical. He seems awfully fond of you." "Yes," I said, as much to myself as to her, "and I would very much like to know why." I was a long time finding the answer, if I ever did. We saw Uncle Alfred frequently in the days that followed. I do not recall exactly how he first introduced the subject of his farm, but each time we visited him, he talked more and more enthusiastically of it. Strictly as a farm, it was nothing, he told us, only a few acres in the hills upstate. An old house, dating from revolutionary times, that had been restored and modernized. A small orchard, a plot or two of vegetables. But the pigs, that was the attraction for him. He boasted that he had 6 of the finest pens of pedigreed hogs in the country, and when he spoke of them, it was with the same admiration and affection that a hunter lavishes upon his dog. Shortly after our first meeting, Uncle Alfred insisted that Annette and I spend a weekend with him at the farmhouse. We found the place much as he had described it, a rather charming old building set among ancient fruit trees. At a little distance, there was a modern barn, which was flanked by a series of elaborately constructed pig pens. I had always thought of pigs as wallowing in mud and refuse, but these pens were as clean and dry as the cage of any animal in the zoo. Each enclosure contained 4 well-groomed hogs. George Harris lived on the property and acted as a caretaker. He was a lanky, leather-skinned farmer, surly in manner, taciturn, and completely without humor of any civilized variety. From the beginning, however, I was conscious of a bond of sympathy between Harris and me. Unspoken and unadmitted, I believe it was nonetheless real. Annette was more charitable than I. She loved the house, the pigs did not disgust her, and she was even able to persuade herself that Uncle Alfred's almost insane fondness for them was somehow praiseworthy. Even when he would get into the pen with them, scratch their bristly backs with a stick, call them individually by name, and grunt crooningly at them, Annette felt only a kind of sorrow for the loveless life that had brought my uncle at last to pigs. On that first evening at my uncle's house in New York, he had said, "Remember, children, I have great plans for you." But I doubt very much if he spoke the truth. Instead, I think he realized that eventually he would have a plan when he had had time to devise one of sufficient intricacy. When the scheme finally emerged, it was so delicately constructed, so beautifully balanced, that I completely failed to recognize it. One night, my uncle said, "Julian, my boy, I don't know if I ever told you that I have several important business interests in South America. As you can see, I'm not built for traveling, so I've always employed agents to represent me. But agents are not always entirely trustworthy. Now, if only you could speak Spanish." The offer expanded slowly and alluringly, like dawn that begins with a line of light on the horizon and gradually sets the whole sky ablaze. First, I would give up my miserable job and devote my entire time for a period of 3 or 4 weeks to the study of the South American enterprises and to learning enough Spanish to handle my uncle's affairs. Then, Annette and I could be married and sail to Rio for our honeymoon. The salary would be large, but even this was not all. In addition, Uncle Alfred proposed to make me his sole heir. There was one other detail. Uncle Alfred insisted that Annette give up her work and the room where she lived. He wished her to stay at the Savoy Plaza at his expense. Laughing, he said that she must begin to accustom herself to life as the wife of a rich man. The month of preparation went according to my uncle's schedule. Annette spent most of her time shopping for her trousseau, and my days were filled by my studies. On the date set for our marriage, we three went to the farm, where it was my uncle's whim to have the ceremony performed. We would spend the night there and sail in the morning for Brazil. All the arrangements were in Uncle Alfred's hands, hiring the minister, buying the tickets, and so on. Apparently, he enjoyed playing Lord Bountiful, for his face was like a smiling mold of jelly. When we arrived at the farm, the weather was unnaturally warm and threatening. Heavy, sluggish clouds hung low in the sky. The air was oppressively still, and it seemed to me that I could feel the vibration of distant thunder, though it was not yet audible. Even the hogs seemed affected by the sultry atmosphere. They were restless and irritable, and kept up an annoying squeal of complaint. Uncle Alfred's gaiety was somewhat dampened by the discovery that George Harris was absent without leave. He said that he supposed Harris would show up in time to feed the pigs, but meanwhile he strongly disapproved of the man leaving the farm alone, even for a short while. Suppose something should happen to one of the hogs, with nobody here to help. Annette and I were in a state of comatose bliss. Our new life lay before us, but had not yet quite begun. With my arm around her, I remember wandering around the house and grounds, saying little, thinking of nothing but the future that we owed entirely to the kindness of my uncle. The minister was expected at 2:00. At 3:00, he had not arrived, and since the sky was growing more and more ominous, I began to fear that if he did not come soon, a storm might interfere with making the trip that day. Uncle Alfred said that he would telephone to find out the reason for the delay. He waddled out of the living room and down the hall to his own bedroom where the telephone was. As I heard his door close, I heard also the first deep growl of thunder. The passage of time meant nothing to Annette and me, but I suppose it must have been more than half an hour later when Uncle Alfred appeared in the doorway and clapped his pink hand to his forehead in a gesture of despair. "My God, Julian," he groaned, "the most terrible thing has happened. I don't know how to tell you. I can't tell you." We stared at him. "What is it?" I demanded. "The minister?" "No, not that. I tried to reach him and there was no answer, so I suppose he's on his way. If it were only that." "Then what?" "Afterwards, you see, I called my office. I won't stop to tell you all about it now, but..." He sighed deeply. "Julian, my boy, you must fly to Mexico City at once. My office has made a reservation for you on the earliest plane. We must leave here within an hour." As I started to protest, he handed me a long envelope that was sealed in a number of places with red wax. "Here, take this. I'll tell you about it before you go. Oh, Julian, I'm so sorry about this, so sorry." Then he sighed again and added, "But journeys end in lovers' meeting, you know. Annette will follow you as soon as your mission is finished." I interrupted, "Why shouldn't she come with me now?" "Ah," he said, "there was another piece of bad luck, terrible luck. There was only room for one more passenger on the plane. But don't worry, I'll send her to you at the first possible moment." He put his arm as far as it would go around her waist and murmured, "Poor, poor girl." Annette looked at me with shining eyes. "It's all right, it's your job. I can understand that. I'll follow you, darling." "Of course she will," Uncle Alfred assured me. "And if there isn't time for you to be married here, she'll marry you wherever you are, won't you, my dear?" I was enraged by something indefinable in my uncle's manner, or perhaps it was by the situation itself. In any case, I remember the insane itch to sink my fingers into my uncle's fat neck to squeeze the life from his disgusting body. But I stood silent in the gloomy room, as if waiting for the next thing to happen. Annette released herself, came to me, and put her hands on my shoulders. Raising her head, she whispered, "Think of the future, darling. We'll be so happy for so long." I kissed her, and my anger was gone. The thunder had grown louder, and suddenly there was a piercing squeal from one of the hogs, as if it were being injured. My uncle trundled out of the room, calling back, "Come along, Julian. I'll tell you what you must know while I see what's the matter." I held Annette a moment longer before I followed. The sky was boiling black, with intermittent flashes of lightning on the horizon. But so far there was little wind and no rain. The pens were over 100 yards from the house, and not visible from it, owing to the curve of the hill. As I started along the path, I heard steps behind me and turned to see George Harris coming around the corner of the porch. "Looks like bad weather," I said. "Where have you been? My uncle's been looking for you." Has he? Why? Anything missing? Missing? I repeated. I'll ask him myself. We walked a few paces side by side. I only came back for a saw, I forgot. We had topped the hill and were looking down at Uncle Alfred, who was bending over one of the hogs in the third pen, before Harris's statement struck me as curious. I halted and said, "What do you mean? Has something happened between you and Mr. Fry?" "Why, sure, didn't you know? I'm fired. He called me up yesterday and told me to be off the place by this morning." Distant lightning glinted in Harris's sardonic eyes as I gazed at him wonderingly. Why had Uncle Alfred pretended to think that Harris would return? The answer was in the closed cell of my brain. I knew it was there, but I could not find it. "That's strange," I said at last, and we went down the hill to the pen, inside of which my uncle was comforting one of his swine. Without looking up, my uncle said, "Galahad has scratched himself on a nail or something of the sort. Awful thing to happen at a moment like this, just when I've got to give you your instructions and send you off." Harris cut in, "Did you want to see me?" My uncle was obviously startled. He jerked his head around and exclaimed, "What? Oh, Harris. No, I don't want to see you. Why would I? I spoke to you yesterday and I haven't changed my mind." Harris nodded and leaned against the wall of the pen. My uncle stood up. Sweat was glistening on his forehead and jowls. His upper lip was raised over his yellow teeth, and he looked less human than usual. "Well," he cried, "get on about your business. I've got to talk to my nephew." "Sure," said Harris. "I just wondered if you knew the telephone line's been cut. I noticed it when I came around the house just now." "Damn you," my uncle shouted. "Go on, I won't listen to your nonsense." He turned to me. "Julian, you must hurry. Go before the storm breaks. You'll find the man at the address on the letter. I'll wire you there." At that moment, the hog named Galahad broke away and trotted painfully to the far end of the pen. My uncle trotted after him. And then a wide, blinding river of fire spilled out of the sky. I heard it sizzle and crackle before the thunder came, and before the thunder had echoed away, I smelled the sulfur strong in the still air. I turned to Harris and said shakily, "That was close." Harris was staring into the pen, a look of amazement on his face. As my gaze followed his, I too was amazed. My uncle had disappeared. I said, "Did you see him go? How did he get away so quickly?" Suddenly the rain began to fall as if it were dashed out of buckets, but Harris remained a few seconds, leaning over the wall of the pen. "Five," I heard him mutter. "Yes, by God, five." I waited no longer but ran back to the house, where I arrived soaked and breathless. Annette met me at the door, pale and frightened. "Wasn't the lightning ghastly? Where's Uncle Alfred?" "Isn't he here?" And then it occurred to me where he must have gone. "Oh," I said, "he's in the barn, of course, though how he got away so quickly I can't imagine." Harris came striding out of the rain and joined us on the porch. I noticed he was carrying the handsaw he had mentioned, and I asked, "Did you go to the barn?" "Yes." "Was Mr. Fry there?" He looked at me in what I thought was a very curious way, but he made no answer, and I asked the question again. "Did you see Mr. Fry when you got your saw out of the barn?" A strange, almost mocking smile spread over Harris's angular face. Slowly, he dropped the lid over one eye in an adagio wink, and at last he uttered the one syllable, "No." "Then where is he?" "If you don't know," said Harris, "I don't know." Annette said, "You both better come in and dry your clothes. Anyhow, darling, you can't possibly get to the airport in this weather." "No, these clay roads will be impassable for at least several hours. I suppose I had better phone Uncle Alfred's office to have them cancel the plane reservation. But I wish he'd come back here. I don't really know what to do." Harris chuckled deep in his chest, and then I remembered what he had said about the telephone. I told him that he must be mistaken about it, because Uncle Alfred was making a call just a few minutes before. Harris said, "Try it if you want to." As I started out of the room, he asked, "Did you notice how many hogs there was in that pen we was leaning over?" "Four," I said. "There were four in each of the pens. You know that better than I." "There's five in that pen now," Harris told me. "And next time you go down, I'll ask you to look close at one hog in particular. He's the biggest and the fattest, and he's got no ring in his nose." Apparently, this meant much more to Harris than to me. To me, the explanation seemed obvious, simply that Uncle Alfred had bought a new hog during Harris's absence. I did not begin to take the man seriously until I raised the telephone receiver to my ear. The line was dead. The discovery of the severed telephone was the first link in a chain of astonishing revelations. As soon as the condition of the road permitted, Annette, Harris, and I drove down to the village of Oak Tree. Through the drugstore telephone, I began to learn some of the truth about my missing uncle. Uncle Alfred had never spoken to the minister whom he had been expecting. I called the North-South Continental Company, which was Uncle Alfred's New York headquarters. They had never heard of an Alfred Fry. I called the airport and found, somewhat to my surprise, that there was a reservation in my name. In canceling it, I asked when the ticket had been bought and whether there was more room on the plane. There was more room, and the passage had been reserved 3 days in advance. While I still sat in the telephone booth, Annette and Harris waiting outside, I tore open the elaborately sealed envelope Uncle Alfred had given me. It was addressed to Carlos Diaz, Hotel Geneva, Mexico City, and it contained 2 sheets of perfectly blank paper. For the moment, the problem was too much for me. I went out and told Harris to notify the local authorities of Uncle Alfred's disappearance, and then go back to the house and stay there until he heard from us or we heard from him. He looked at me owlishly. What should I do about the hogs? Damn the hogs, I exclaimed. What difference does it make to me? Do anything. Even the new one? Of course. If I thought anything, I suppose I thought the man was talking about feeding the brutes. Annette and I drove back to New York and went directly to Uncle Alfred's townhouse. The place was closed, shades drawn at all the windows, the front door locked. There we were. The mystery seemed as complete as our despair. But within the next few days, our fortunes took a sudden upward turn. I got a much better position than I could have hoped for, and within a short time, Annette and I were married. So far as I know, Alfred Fry was never seen again. Although it seems impossible that such a tremendously fat man could vanish like an illusion in a distorting mirror, a search has been made for him throughout the world, in vain. If he does not turn up in the time specified by law, his death will be legally presumed, and his considerable estate, which does not include ownership in the North-South Continental Company, will come to me. It seems I am his sole living relative. I hesitate to speak of the night Annette and I spent at the farmhouse, because as a reasonable, unimaginative man, I'm not willing to argue the accuracy of my own impressions. We went up to the country shortly after our marriage, and within a month of my uncle's disappearance. The first thing I noticed was that the pens were completely empty, and I asked Harris what had happened to the hogs. Oh, he said, I sent them to market. You'll be getting a check for them. I said, if my uncle ever shows up, he'll throw you in jail for it. Harris grinned at me. If he ever shows up. After dinner, Annette, Harris, and I talked once again about the mystery of Uncle Alfred. There was little doubt in my mind of what the old devil had planned, and I was certain that if I had made the trip to Mexico, I should never have returned. As I said, whatever happened to him, and however it happened, it seemed to me that only the merest 11th-hour luck had saved my life and spared Annette the most terrible fate. Harris said nothing but sat staring into the firelight. The sound woke me from a deep sleep in the middle of the night, the clatter of hooves on the hardwood floor in the hall outside our door. I waited, listening, while the beast stopped and snuffled along the bottom of the door as if food were just beyond his reach. Then the clatter began again as the hogs started down the hall. I jumped out of bed and was in the long straight corridor before the trotting hooves had reached the end. There was nothing to see. As I stared into empty space, I heard Harris call, "Pig!" And it seemed to me that the sound of the sharp hooves on the bare floor appeared to enter Harris's room, but the door neither opened nor closed. Fortunately, the commotion had not awakened Annette, and I did not wish to frighten her now. I sat up for the rest of the night thinking. I shall not say what I thought, nor shall I advance any theories. But when the estate of my uncle, Alfred Fry, is settled, Harris shall have the farm.